Welcome to KABU, Lauren Regan. It's great to have you on the Old Mole again.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you and other staff at the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene have for years defended activists in civil and criminal cases, often working with movement lawyers in other regions of the country. One of those cases went to trial here in Portland in February, less than 2 months ago, with five Extinction Rebellion activists charged with trespassing at the Zenith Energy Terminal in Northwest Portland. The action was in April 2019 and intended to disrupt operations of this local hub of fossil fuel transport that had recently expanded its capacity for transporting oil through Portland, including the highly toxic tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada. Lauren, can you tell us briefly about the charges against the Extinction Rebellion activists, a local group that's also international, and the choice of the activists to enlist the necessity defense at the trial held at the Multnomah County Courthouse?
Sure. So the Extinction Rebellion Portland group purposefully created a campaign that was going to intentionally cause economic disruption. They put a bunch of soil on the train tracks leading into the Zenith facility. They put a little tiny house there. They planted a garden in the soil. They very intentionally knew that they were risking arrest by engaging in this act. They had built a campaign for many months and the community for years against this expansion of the Zenith terminal and Zenith as one of the largest carbon emitters in Portland and in our bioregion, really. And so when five of them ultimately did get arrested and charged with misdemeanor criminal trespass in the first degree, it was not exactly surprising. And because they had worked their campaign and they had chosen the individuals that were actually going to risk arrest and go to trial in this way, they had done all of the proper legwork that activists need to do in order to bring a viable choice of evils defense before the court.
And there's a lot of planning and thoughtful coordination of activity, activist supports in pursuing this strategy. Let's listen to a clip from the trial where you introduce the necessity defense to jurists and then have you explain more about this strategy and what you hope the jury would hear.
At the heart of this case is the choice of evils, which is ironic given the evidence and testimony that you've heard, because it certainly seems more like a necessity than a choice at this time. But as jurors, you do have a choice. At the end of this case, you can find that the defendant's actions are not criminal. You can make the determination that all of these defendants are not guilty of criminal trespass.
This is Jan Hocken talking this morning with Lauren Regan, attorney with the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene. Lauren, what were you hoping the jurors would hear in that appeal? In a way, it's a very common sense. Unlike many arcane forms of legal reasoning, there's a common sense appeal to this legal strategy. And at the same time, there are many elements to it that jurors may struggle with. What were you hoping jury would hear?
Yeah, so the larger framework is the jury, which is supposed to act as the conscience of a community. You know, they're supposed to be sort of the moral compass. They have the final decision-making authority as to whether a defendant is going to be found guilty or not guilty. And so at its heart, we were basically telling them, we have these scales that we are balancing, that the court is allowing you to balance. On the one hand is the imminent threat of catastrophic climate change, sea level rise, forest fires, health impacts. They can be both local and global in nature. They are serious. They are imminent. They are an existential crisis to the survival of the human race. And on the other hand is this temporary economic disruption that resulted in a trespassing charge. It's your duty to balance these scales and determine whether or not these individuals should be held criminally responsible or not for that charge of criminal trespass. The court read a jury instruction to them. In every trial, it's the judge's job to instruct the jury about the law, you know, basically to give them the roadmap that they have to follow with regard to the law. And, you know, one of the very unique things with this case is this was the first case in the history of the United States that we know of where the climate necessity defense was allowed to go fully through the process, meaning we were allowed to put on climate experts to testify in front of the jury. We were allowed to put graphs and exhibits and evidence in front of the jury about the harms and the imminence and the effectiveness of direct action as a tactic. And then the judge actually gave them an instruction that said, you're allowed to do this balancing. And so what the judge read to the jury was, the defense of choice of evils has been raised. Conduct that would otherwise constitute an offense is justifiable and not criminal when the defendant's conduct is necessary as an emergency measure to avoid an imminent injury and the threatened injury from climate change is of such gravity that according to ordinary standards of intelligence and morality, the desirability and urgency of the defendant's avoiding the injury from climate change clearly outweighs the desirability of avoiding the injury sought to be prevented by the law that makes criminal trespass in the first degree a crime.
What are the elements of the defense, which as I understand it, there are four elements of the defense that you, and you listed a number of them that have to be established, although not all have to be met. Is that correct? But in addition to clarifying that, could you speak to what jurors seem to struggle with most?
Sure. So 5 out of 6 of the jurors voted not guilty in this case. One juror basically got hung up on the idea that, you know, criminal trespass is a crime. They obviously trespassed on the train tracks and on the property of Zenith, and he just was unable to do this balancing that the court was requiring. So what that said is 5 out of 6 of the jurors, using ordinary standards of intelligence and morality, you know, morality, I think, is actually the important part of this. The court basically told them, use your intelligence, use your own ethics and morality, and do this balancing. The desirability and urgency of avoiding catastrophic climate change versus the desirability of avoiding criminal trespass in the first degree.
It sounds like Good Samaritan laws or similar, in that there are ways that professionals are protected or others are protected in situations where they're trying to provide aid to someone in need and cross some line in doing so that otherwise would be protected around privacy.
I mean, choice of evils defenses are also called justification defenses, necessity defenses. You know, in Montana, they're called compulsion defenses. And I think they're different than Good Samaritan. Good Samaritan law basically means if I stop and try to help somebody on the side of the highway that's having a heart attack and they die, the family can't sue me for attempting to give them CPR and them dying nonetheless. That's a mm-hmm. civil liability issue, not a criminal issue.
It's so that's different. An important distinction.
Yeah, it's different, but you know, I think what you're trying to get at, and I think, you know, the similarity is that the intention of these defenses and this law is based on the idea of, like, the public interest, and that sometimes you do the right thing even though you might be risking trouble from the law, you know.
And is there anything else you'd like to say about in assessing the outcome of the trial that resulted in a mistrial? And there's a celebratory tone to some of the environmental groups as they've announced this as a partial victory. How would you assess it? And then what's your take on the use of this legal strategy and going forward, particularly in that we're in a very uncertain landscape around direct action, civil disobedience in the climate movement?
Well, I think it is an incredible victory for the climate movement in that, you know, we have now had a full test case go through the process of utilizing the climate necessity defense and ultimately having an overwhelming majority of the jurors vote in our favor. It's always a big ask to say to society, even though this is a crime, this person should not be held responsible to breaking the law. You know, there are people that have a law and order orientation that get really nervous that the underpinnings of a safe society might crumble if you don't have this black or white, it's legal or it's not. And I think that was the sixth juror's hang up, was that he wanted to view the law as black and white and finite, and you either broke the law or you didn't. There wasn't any middle ground or any ethical considerations that could come into play. Just because a law is on the books doesn't mean it is always going to be enforced in a just way.
Mm-hmm.
The other things that I would say is 5 out of 6 jurors voting that moral duty in favor of saving the planet is big. You know, that is big. You know, it's not as great as the 6 of them saying it, but, you know, I mean, if you were to take this, you know, out of the courtroom context, you would almost be saying 5 out of 6 people in your community, even if they don't call themselves climate activists or environmentalists, think that fighting for a livable planet is the right thing to do. 5 out of 6, you know, that's pretty major. The other thing is that as a result of this trial, the state and Multnomah County decided not to re-prosecute. And so they dismissed the charges against the defendants, and no one got convicted for blatantly committing criminal trespass, you know, for planting a garden on a corporation's train tracks.
That's a choice the judge can make after a hung jury or mistrial. The judge has the latitude to decide on whether the DA's office, sorry.
The district attorney's office has the discretion to either re-prosecute or dismiss the charges. And in another case that we've had going on for years up in Washington in Skagit County with another climate defender, Ken Ward, you know, we're about to go to trial for the third time because we have had a hung jury the first time, the Court of Appeals ruled in our favor the second time, and now they're going to go at it a third jury trial for the same incident. So the fact that Multnomah County dismissed the charges and decided not to re-prosecute is a big deal. And I have to say that part of my belief on why they made that decision was because all sorts of really bad stuff came out in that courtroom about Zenith Energy.
Yeah.
And Zenith Energy was the quote-unquote victim of this crime. And I think Zenith Energy did not want to have all that bad stuff come out into a public courtroom again. You know, they had no defense for all of the really bad stuff that they've done and are doing. And I don't think they wanted that to happen again. So I think that Zenith had a role to play in making the decision of whether these folks were re-prosecuted. And I think the corporations, the fossil fuel industry, learned a lesson that even if these people were convicted and found guilty of trespassing, they still got what they wanted and needed out of the public courtroom, which was to finally be able to put into the sterile laboratory of a courtroom all of the reasons that they were willing to go to jail in order to try and draw attention to and stop Zenith Energy. And that is, I think, very powerful for the movement, a great test case. And the fact that, like, the corporation and the state then chose to, kind of lick their wounds and move on to something else, I think speaks volumes.
And it is quite different political climate for climate resistance, different regions of the country where communities are more or less dependent on the fossil fuel industry in their area. You know, in Minnesota, the status of Enbridge and its power in that community during that trial of valve turners confronted different resistances to the situation here in Multnomah County. It seems that Zenith is itself seen as kind of trespassing on the community and an interloper in a way. It doesn't have the same power and economic clout here. How much does that weigh into jury sympathies?
Well, you're exactly right. You know, when we were in Minnesota and North Dakota on the valve turner trials, we had potential jurors say climate change is a hoax perpetuated by the Chinese. These are eco-terrorists that tried to blow up our communities, and they should get the death penalty. You know, we literally had potential jurors saying things like that. They obviously did not get on the jury. Both Minnesota and North Dakota, well, in North Dakota, we never were allowed to use the necessity defense. In Minnesota, we were allowed to use it, but the court ruled in our favor and acquitted all of the defendants before we even got to put on our experts.
The rug was pulled out from under the strategy at the end during the announcement, the week of the announcement of the urgency of the climate crisis,
But in Gadsden County, Washington, and even in North Dakota, and in both of those cases, we weren't allowed to put on the full climate necessity defense yet. You know, we will as soon as Corona passes in Washington. But even without putting on expert testimony, just having the defendants testify about what their intent was and why they were compelled to face arrest and, you know, and turn off these valves. After the trials were over, we had conservative rural landowners come up to us and thank us for educating them about climate change and thanking them for trying to help their communities. And so a big part of using the courtroom as part of a climate campaign is potentially trying to educate people that you might not normally be able to talk to or that you might not have normal connections to. And when you do it in a courtroom, there's this semblance of legitimacy to it, you know, because it's a courtroom. When the judge says that something is admissible or not, the jurors are able to sort of test that evidence and test the theories, and everything is quiet and it's very focused, and they're not multitasking on their phones at the same time. You know, it's actually a very focused laboratory to be able to see how society might be able to be impacted or changed, you know, with regard to their beliefs around climate change. And I think in all of the cases that I've been a part of, it has been a very effective tool in building trust and educating people that we would normally not have the opportunity, I think, to build that kind of trust with.
Including across rural and urban divides that seem to be like the generational divide, sometimes quite daunting, finding common ground. In late March, the governors of Kentucky, South Dakota, and West Virginia all signed laws designating oil and gas pipelines and facilities, critical infrastructure, and imposing new penalties against people protesting this area of infrastructure. This has been going on a long time. It's not new. In closing, could you just speak to that way in which the pandemic is heightening the stakes on both sides, both defenders of the fossil fuel industry and activists, water and land protectors working on the front lines, and where you see hope and pitfalls in the landscape ahead?
Well, generally, the history of state repression and the corporations and people with power trying to pass laws to uneven the playing field to benefit themselves. You know, when you see corporations like the fossil fuel industry passing all these critical energy infrastructure laws, it's not going to deter any activists from continuing to work on their campaigns and to continue to risk arrest, because activists that risk arrest already know that they might face criminal charges. And because the prosecutor has all the discretion in what they're actually charged with, there was always a threat, potentially, that an activist would end up with a felony. So whether it's called criminal mischief or critical energy infrastructure or felony trespassing or whatever it might be, that's not going to deter an activist from engaging in direct action and economic disruption. What I think those types of laws tell us, though, in a positive light, is that the industry is on its heels. The industry believes that the only way that they are going to maintain society being okay with them profiting off of killing the planet is by passing laws so that they can say, look, we're the good guys. We have these laws on the books that say those activist people are the bad guys, they're the criminals. And for that law and order component of society, if there's a law that says if you walk on a pipeline easement, you're a felon, well then those that walk on the pipeline easement must be bad guys, and the people who are maintaining those pipeline easements must be the good guys. You know, that's what the industry is hoping will be the outcome of these kinds of laws. But I think more and more what we're seeing is people are really becoming wise to the idea that that industry has spent billions and billions and billions of dollars subverting our democracy and subverting all of the normal systems that we as Americans should be able to utilize to advocate for ourselves and to protect the public interest. And I think more and more they are being outed as the rich bully in the sandbox that is tipping the scales in a way that is both unfair and undemocratic. And I think that this onslaught of ALEC-sponsored fossil fuel industry gifts in the legislature may actually backfire on them. All those legislators with their hands out taking that fossil fuel money should probably go find another job. And they should be replaced by people who aren't going to take bribes and corruption and actually are going to be there to represent the people that they are elected to represent. And I believe that the overwhelming majority of those people desire clean water and a livable planet for themselves and their children.
As the airs have cleared in this pandemic, perhaps some of the clarity of those points will also be more visible. Lauren Regan, thank you so much for your work and being on the Old Mole with us today again, and we look forward to hearing further. I think your work is so important, and we want to support it in whatever way we can, as well as hopefully taking the streets again when we are able to as well.
We are doing a weekly webinar for activists right now while everyone's in quarantine. Every Thursday at 3 p.m. we're doing an online webinar on a different topic. The next 3 weeks is a three-part Know Your Rights training for climate activists, and then the 2 weeks after that is Know Your Rights for youth climate defenders, and people can go to our website to register for those and to find out the details if they're interested. But we might as well build skills and build power while we are stuck in our houses.
Thank you so much, Lauren Regan. We look forward to following you and encouraging our listeners to join the webinars and think creatively as the Necessity Defense calls for drawing on history in creative ways. We continue this movement more urgent than ever. Thank you so much for being with us today.
And thank you for having me.
I come to the garden alone while the dew is still on the roses, and the voice I hear falling on my ear, the Son of God discloses.
And he walks with me, and he talks with me, and he tells me I am his own. And the joy we share as we tarry there, none other has ever known.
He speaks in the sound of his voice. It's so sweet, the birds hush their singing, and the melody that he gave to me with him.